Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Just watch your steps. Pete Zanneman is an ER doctor, but today he's traded his scrubs for a parka and the hospital for a nature reserve in New Jersey.
Right now, I am in a snow-covered field with 16 fourth-year medical students.
Pete is teaching a course on disaster medicine, and the med students are camping out here for a whole week to learn in an immersive setting.
So last night, we had them organize into two teams and create shelters that they would sleep in, where they would sleep with no tent, no sleeping bag, no matches, no nothing. And it was about 38 degrees and raining all night.
Wow.
And they did very, very well.
But they burned a hole in the top of the tent.
Pete tells me it's not a tent, just a tarp they've strung up between tree branches.
But it's okay. It's a cheap tarp. They did burn a hole in that.
All week long, the students brave the elements and do different exercises, learn how to make stretchers and splints out of sticks, make a fire without a lighter. They are dropped into different emergency scenarios with volunteer fake patients.
So we're going to need to look at her back. She's got some bruising on the abdomen, so we're going to have to do very carefully.
Basically, they learn how to care for patients in less than ideal conditions with very few resources. It's preparation should they ever find themselves responding to a fire, an earthquake, a mass shooting. Pete is also the head of disaster preparedness at Penn Medicine in Philadelphia, a big hospital system. He says being out in the field is just a small aspect of getting ready for serious emergencies.
It's not all sexy, exciting drills with people wearing hazmat suits. And really, it boils down to a few people sitting in a room, writing out plans and thinking through scenarios.
For a hospital, being prepared means doctors, nurses, administrators, building engineers, they all have to come around the table together and know their roles. The guy who can keep the generators working is just as important as the surgeon who can stitch up wounds.
Those different professionals getting together in the same room and talking, developing a personal relationship, a first name basis.
They also have to think about how a community or hospital can become more resilient.
Making sure that your staff has all gotten the flu vaccine, making sure that you have more than one vendor for critical supplies and infrastructure.
Pete says the best you can do is make general plans that could work in a variety of situations so that everything clicks into gear.
Disaster planning and disaster response is truly a team sport.
Today's episode is about emergencies and disasters, how we prepare for them, and what we do when they strike.
Let's start with our APC7 traffic map. The fog advisory is covering all of LA County, including the coastal, the I-405.
There's roughly a 50% chance that the Los Angeles region will be hit by a major earthquake sometime in the next 30 years. A new podcast called The Big One is all about how a massive quake would affect the 10 million people who live in that area. The show is produced by KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. In one episode, they explore how hospitals will handle an onslaught of injured people. Host Jacob Margolis spoke with an emergency room physician who has some experience with that. He lived through a big one already, the last major quake to strike the LA region, which happened in 1994.
It's 4:30 in the morning, and Dr. Greg Moran's doing some paperwork at his desk. He's wrapping up his overnight shift at the emergency department at Northridge Hospital, when all of a sudden, the Northridge quake hits.
I initially felt a little shake, so I just kind of reflexively stood up and got in the doorway that was right next to me, just a couple feet away from me. And as I got in the doorway, then a very violent shake happened. I mean, it felt like everything moved a couple of feet into one side very suddenly. And then there was a lot of noise. And when that big shake happened, all of the lights went out. We lost our power. I realized I was pretty helpless. There wasn't really anything I could do other than stand there and hope that the entire hospital building was not going to collapse on top of me.
The shaking finally stops. The lights come back on and it's chaos. Computers are on the floor, carts have tipped over, water's pouring out of the ceiling, and there's a thick cloud of dust in the air.
The room that I had been sitting in, this very small doctor's office, was a couple of rooms away from the outside of the hospital, but the wall opened up. The wall of the room that I was sitting in split open by about 6 inches, and I could look through into the room next to it, which was the waiting room, and then through that entire room, and there was another wall on the outside that had also cracked open. So I could see through two rooms to the outside of the building because the very hospital cracked. The building itself cracked and split.
Moran checks on his colleagues, and luckily everyone's okay. They have no idea just how bad things are.
There was an information blackout at first. We didn't know what the extent of it was. As it turned out, we were pretty much at the epicenter or very near the epicenter of the earthquake. It took a while before we even got any reliable information about what was going on. It wasn't until a little bit later, as we started to seeing some police and first responders coming in, that we got at least some secondhand information about the extent of it, where it was located, what was the extent of the devastation in the city.
They know a bunch of people are going to show up at the hospital, but their emergency department is completely ruined. There's no way they're going to be able to treat people in there. So they head outside to work on people in the parking lot.
And as we were setting it up, we already were seeing some of that initial wave of the walking wounded come in. And I do remember, it was dark, it was nighttime, and I have this image in my head of almost a, zombie apocalypse type scenario of just seeing the people who are kind of injured and kind of slowly lumbering out of the dark to come into the parking lot where we were assessing them. So then we basically just started to work. There were a few critical people that we saw coming in. I remember one of the very first patients that we saw was a poor guy who worked in a donut shop and had gone in early to open up the donut shop. And as all the shaking happened, the hot oil for the donuts splashed him, and he had pretty extensive bad burns over a good part of his body. And so he was one of the early ones that showed up. He was one of the sicker early ones that showed up.
Most people aren't nearly as hurt as him. The most common injury Moran sees is people that need help getting glass out of their feet.
And that was because the time this happened, at 4:30 a.m., people are in bed. The shaking starts, they get thrown out of bed, they, hear everything crashing and shaking, they kind of freak out, and what's their first instinct? Run outside. And often they're running outside through broken glass sliding doors, broken windows, things like that. There's stuff shattered. It's 4:30 in the morning, they're in bed, they're barefoot, and so they're running through their house and stepping on broken glass as they get outside. We spent a lot of time digging little pieces of glass out of the bottoms of people's feet.
The hospital's overwhelmed, but Greg's totally focused. He's treating as many people as he can, but to his surprise, there are all these people showing up who aren't hurt. They're just freaking out.
I remember there was this one relatively young guy, and he'd had a prior spinal injury. He was in a wheelchair from a prior spinal injury. He was paraplegic, and he didn't have any injuries. There were no new injuries from the earthquake, but he was just freaking out. He just lost it.
Remember what he was saying?
He was just saying, no, you need to take care of me. You need to help me. I did an assessment of him. He had no physical injuries, but he was just, basically screaming, carrying on. At one point, I remember he threw himself down on the floor out of his wheelchair and was just screaming that we needed to help him. And, I didn't know what to do other than, give him some sedatives, which we did, and just try to, put him back in his wheelchair. But the one reason that one particularly stands out was that he was actually kind of interfering with us taking care of other people who were injured.
Was he okay?
He was okay.
Okay. When the big one hits, hospitals across Southern California are going to be overwhelmed. There are going to be about 50,000 people that need help. Some hospitals themselves are going to be damaged. Some won't even be usable.
The reality is right now in America, in emergency medicine, we sometimes struggle day to day just to keep up with the regular flow.
If you've ever been to an emergency room, you know that it can take forever to get treated. And when this happens, that wait's going to be even longer, especially if you're not that badly hurt. But even if you do have a serious injury, well...
Do you feel like more people will die from serious injuries that could have been treated during a normal time versus when the big one hits and hospitals are overwhelmed?
Yes. We expect that will happen. Yes.
That story was reported by Jacob Margolis for a new podcast called The Big One. It explores earthquake science and asks just how disaster-ready we all are. In California, earthquake preparation is really important, and each episode ends with practical survival tips from lead producer Misha Youssef. She's here now to share some of those tips with us. Hey, Misha.
Hi, Maiken.
So... what do we do? What will give me the best chance of doing okay after a big earthquake?
I think the most important thing is to prepare beforehand. The most commonly heard wisdom from seismologists and people in the emergency preparedness sector is that as soon as the shaking starts, you're supposed to drop, cover, and hold on.
So let's say I'm sitting at my desk, drop under the desk? What do I hold on to?
Yeah. So if you're sitting at your desk, I would get under the desk and hold on to one of the side pillars or the top. And the reason that holding on is important is because when the ground is shaking, even if you're under something and you're covered, you're likely to get thrown all over the place. So just holding on makes sure that you're still protected and safe.
So that's better than trying to get out of the building?
Yes, because the buildings in California especially, but most of the United States are safer than buildings in other parts of the world. And the running out of the building wisdom comes from places where the building is likely to collapse. But our buildings here in Southern California are built so that people can at least crawl out of them alive. And if you try to run when the shaking is happening, you're going to likely hurt your legs, maybe break your foot. You know, things are going to fall all over the place. So you might get some glass in your feet. And so the injuries are only going to keep you from getting outside of the building. And if you're trapped or something falls on you, then that's more dangerous than having some sort of cover above your head that's protecting your body.
What else should I do? How do I get in touch with people? How do I communicate that I'm still alive, I'm here, I'm under my desk?
Yeah. So, you know, if you're like at a Beyonce concert, for example, a lot of times you can't get through to your friends who might be outside or who you're waiting for. And that's because the bandwidth is stretched really thin. A lot of people are making calls or texting at the same time. So you have a better chance of texting than calling. If you're a super prepper, you probably have a walkie-talkie on you at that point and can reach people through that.
Yeah, probably not.
That's next level stuff. But shooting a quick text, or if you feel that you're trapped in a building, saving your voice and making rhythmic noises with an object that you're able to find nearby is much more likely to help in the long run, because then you can use your voice when people are actually nearby and guide them to where you are rather than losing your voice by that point.
What about food and water, depending on how long one gets stuck?
Yeah, so seismologist Dr. Lucy Jones says, however much water you have, get more. The recommendation is 1 gallon per person per day, or animal also. So you want to have about 1 gallon of water for a week or 2 weeks per person stored in your like primary location, like your home. And then having a water bottle in your purse at all times, a water bottle in your car, at your desk, those are like the absolute minimums. And then same with food. You want to have enough food for 3 days to a week, at least for each person and animal in your family. And then you want to have some sort of snack bar or any kind of food at your desk, in your car, in your bag, wherever you might find yourself.
That's producer Misha Youssef from the podcast The Big One. And here's some more advice. If you live in a place like California, make sure you have shoes under your bed so your feet won't get cut if you have to walk over broken glass or on debris. And be sure to wear pajamas when you go to sleep because you don't want to have to run out of your house naked. Let's talk about some of the people who are in the first line of defense when emergencies happen. EMTs, paramedics. If you've ever had to be transported in an ambulance, it was probably a really scary moment. Who are the people that are coming to our rescue? How much do we really know about them? What their jobs are like? When you call 911, you might expect that the ambulance from your city or county shows up. But actually, in many instances, it's private for-profit companies that answer that call. And some of those who work for those private companies say they are stretched way too thin. Jad Slayman looked into this situation in the state of California.
A California paramedic sets the scene.
Well, the thing is, we all know it's messed up.
He asked me not to use his name to protect his job.
Everybody who's worked in private EMS for more than a couple of years gets somewhat jaded about it. You know, there's just this expectation of I'm going to get screwed. And that's just the way it is.
He works for AMR, American Medical Response. It's the nation's largest for-profit ambulance company, with more than 6,000 ambulances in 41 states. He tells me about his first day when he went in to sort his schedule.
And the person to whom I talked to was like, oh, but, you know, if you work these kind of schedules, you know, you can pick up a lot of overtime because you work nights and then you can pick up the days. And if you are trying to actually make a living doing this, you work a lot of overtime.
Working 12-hour shifts, he says, you may get some downtime here and there, but often it's relentless.
You know, if we're running 10, 12, 13, 14 calls, they might be trying to pull you from the hospital and you're getting paged. Hey, can you clear? We need you to clear. We have a call.
He's saying he's still dropping off one patient in the ER, but dispatch has another one he needs to get to.
They might even just dispatch you without even asking, and then you have to go try to get your paperwork signed and back to the truck and run the next call.
He spends almost his entire shift on the road. When he gets time to go to the bathroom, it's at a convenience store or behind a bush. And there's no telling exactly when his shift will end. He's supposed to get off at 10, but maybe a call comes in at 9:45. It's called a holdover, and it can stretch your 12-hour tour out to 14 or 15 hours.
You almost always work multiple consecutive days, which means, you know, if you do get held over 2 or 4 hours, it's impossible to get sleep. I've had partners, though, where I'm like, no, man, pull over. This is not safe. You can't do this.
That late call could be easy, a rolled ankle, or it could be a pedestrian struck at high speed.
You know, I mean, more than once, it's been like, okay, you know, I'm on hour 13, 14, and now I have a traumatic code, you know, and this person's only chance of surviving is me doing my job right.
A couple years ago, it looked like life might be getting a bit better for ambulance workers like him. It had to do with break times. They're mandated by California law, but ambulance workers don't really get breaks the same way a barista might. EMS workers never know when the next call will come in, that heart attack or that kid with asthma, so they have to be at the ambulance, monitoring the radio, ready to respond immediately at all times. Our paramedic says the closest thing he gets to what you might consider a break is calling in something called a code 7.
We don't really get breaks. Those don't really exist anymore. They still use the term code 7, but it usually just means I'm going to stop at a gas station on my way from point A to point B, and I'm just telling you that's what I'm doing.
In 2016, the California Supreme Court ruled on-call breaks are illegal when it comes to security guards. The court said basically, these guards, they're on the radio during their breaks. They're on duty. That's not a real break. And how you define break is important. State law says if you don't get one, you get paid an extra hour's wages. EMTs and medics hoped this ruling would apply to them, too. They'd filed similar lawsuits in the past.
The idea of, wow, we're supposed to get a break was pretty powerful, I think, to a lot of people. The idea of like, hey, you know, the law actually does do something for us.
Ambulance workers told me this wasn't just about breaks. It was about what real breaks could lead to. Better staffing and better pay. Medics told me they figured private companies would have to hire more people to cover for units on break, keep more ambulances in service per shift. They'd have to stop getting by with what workers say feels like the bare minimum. The paramedic I spoke with says he hoped companies would have to dole out that missed break pay more often. It's pay he says he's never gotten.
They're going to actually have to, there's going to be a lot of back pay. People were excited about that and then about what it might mean moving forward.
But then AMR, that big private company he works for, pushed back. They funded a ballot initiative called Proposition 11. It would let ambulance companies continue to keep ambulance workers on duty during quote-unquote breaks. We asked AMR about its break policies and working conditions. The company wouldn't talk to us on tape for this, but in a statement, a spokesperson said workers have plenty of downtime, and the company supported Prop 11 out of concern for patients. That concern was the line in their commercials, too.
In an emergency, minutes can mean the difference between life and death. Proposition 11 saves lives by ensuring medical care is not delayed in an emergency. Vote yes on 11 to ensure 911 emergency care is there when you or your loved one need it.
The message voters heard was, you have a heart attack. Without Prop 11, the closest ambulance crew could be unavailable because they're on break, their radio off. This could cost you your life. Spots like that blanketed the airways ahead of the vote. The company spent nearly $30 million pushing Prop 11. Ken Jacobs is a labor specialist at the University of California, Berkeley. He did a deep dive into the private EMS industry.
Had I not done any of the research and the work in advance, I would have heard these Prop 11 commercials like everybody else and thought, oh, that's terrible. Of course, people can't have a break while I'm waiting to get my ambulance service.
Ken says instead, he found Prop 11 wasn't really about keeping response times as low as possible. It was about keeping labor costs down. Private sector EMTs barely make minimum wage in parts of California.
A third of the EMS workers earned less than $13.63 an hour. Overall, median hourly wage was $16.59 in the state. So we're talking about low wages, and that those wages have been falling.
Ken says these low wages contribute to a serious retention problem. He found the average private ambulance worker stays with a company only 4 years.
One of the common sort of job trajectories is go in, get trained, get some experience, and then use that as the basis for applying for a firefighter job. And so lots of people are going in with the hopes of getting out and getting into a better paid job elsewhere.
By elsewhere, he means public EMS operations, usually your fire department. The pay can be up to 40% higher there, and workers get the comfort of having a firehouse.
If you look at a city like San Jose, they all have fire stations to go to.
That's Jason Brolini, a union leader for private EMS workers.
Full kitchens, bathrooms, sleep rooms, which is starkly different than private sector EMS.
Techs and medics employed by private companies typically just have their trucks and street corners. Jason says every time the fire departments have openings, when the public system opens up recruitment, this happens.
There's a mass exodus from the private side to the public side. And so we'll go through these periods where staffing is so low that we end up getting forced back to work.
He's saying techs and medics at private companies get called in on their days off because so many others have quit to go public.
You know, I don't blame them for jumping ship. You know, I mean, it's very hard mentally and physically to make a career on the private side.
An important note, it's private ambulances that are the ones responding to most of the 911 calls in California, about 75% of them. Decades of consolidation mean a handful of companies control the lion's share of private ambulances. Ken's research focused on California, but he says working conditions there are reflected nationally. Private EMS offers towns a cheaper alternative to the public system, and they operate in rural areas no one else covers. But industry experts say there's a cost. Tougher working conditions, lower pay, and the higher turnover the union guy Jason described. He says it all adds up to a system that's making it more likely the medic responding to your emergency is going to be exhausted and a rookie.
When I started, your average provider that showed up at your house had anywhere from 15 to 25 years experience.
That was a couple decades ago.
Now with this turnover, we're lucky if it's 8.
A lot of this was missing from the Prop 11 debate. In fact, there wasn't much of a debate at all. By voting day, nearly every major California newspaper had endorsed Prop 11. They called it sensible public safety. In the end, it was a landslide, nearly 60% yes. Prop 11 passed, confirming that on-duty breaks are legal for EMS workers. Medics and techs I spoke with weren't exactly surprised.
I mean, you could teach a semester course on all of the intricacies of an EMS system and how things work.
That's Jason Brolini again, the union leader.
But you know what's very easy to boil down to a 30-second soundbite? Grandma's going to have a heart attack and there's not going to be an ambulance to respond because they're taking a break.
Scary commercials, the state Supreme Court, and the ballot box aside, something else really troubled the ambulance workers I spoke with. There were people, lots of them, that believed EMTs and medics would put their coffee breaks over the call of duty.
There's not one provider that I represent that would say, no, I'm not responding to that call because I need to eat. Not one.
Remember our AMR paramedic, the one we met at the beginning? He says people know they need men and women like him, but they don't really know much about them.
They just want to see the flashy lights when they need help.
So I ask, did this whole thing change the way he looks at his patients, these voters who passed Prop 11?
I never let it affect kind of the way that I view them or treat them. You stop cursing, you put on your gloves, and you go, so what's going on today?
That story was reported by Jad Slayman. We're talking about emergencies and crises right now, focusing on the people who deal with disasters on a regular basis for their jobs. From paramedics to a scientist who uses math to combat epidemics. In 2014, a major Ebola outbreak hit West Africa.
Not only is this the worst Ebola outbreak in history, but according to a doctor with a leading medical organization in Liberia, it's also the first time the virus has spread to urban areas.
And new numbers this morning show another spike in victims of West Africa's deadly Ebola outbreak.
By the time the outbreak was under control, more than 28,000 cases were reported and 11,000 deaths were confirmed in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Adam Kucharski is a researcher at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He builds mathematical models that can illustrate how infectious diseases spread and what could help stop them. Recently, he built a model that measured the impact of treatment facilities and hospital beds that were added in Sierra Leone.
There was obviously a lot of effort and investment had gone into that, but then there was also a lot of criticism that there were claims that maybe this was too late, maybe it didn't actually have much effect in reality. And so our analysis essentially tried to reconstruct the outbreak with the beds in place, reproducing the outbreak as it happened. And then once we'd done that, take away the beds and see, well, what would have happened if those hadn't have been in place when they were. And we estimated that probably about 60,000 cases were prevented as a direct effect of those beds.
Having these treatment beds meant that patients could be isolated and were less likely to transmit the disease to family members and others in their community.
And that was really, in many of these areas, the factor that controlled the outbreak. In the early stages, you'd have someone in the community for maybe 8-9 days. And having the capacity in place to shorten that period was really key to controlling it.
Do we know anything about, had treatment beds been in place earlier, how many deaths could have been prevented or could be prevented in the future?
Once we had this set up that we could add beds or remove beds from this modeling framework, we looked at what happened if the same response had happened 1 month earlier. And we found that actually the outbreak would have been half the size. So it really illustrated that, particularly in the early stages of an outbreak where you've got this rapidly increasing numbers of cases, that every week delay can make a massive difference.
Are we getting better in terms of predicting outbreaks and epidemics, or is part of the nature of it this element of surprise that it will pop up and get a head start on us?
I think we're becoming much better at predicting certain elements. For something like flu or respiratory infections, for example, We've now got a fairly good sense of how social interactions might drive the infection to be in certain age groups more than others. We're developing better understandings of spatial movements or global travel patterns and where the virus might go. But I think working out when and where that new virus will pop up is extremely difficult. I think possibly even be impossible to really pin down.
Does this line of work ever freak you out? It's all abstract until it isn't, you know?
I think there have been some outbreaks historically. If you look at something like a major flu pandemic with a high fatality rate, that's very hard to envision how a modern society would respond to that. But in other circumstances, there are outbreaks where you see a lot of hysteria and perhaps concern where there doesn't necessarily need to be placed in that way. And in that regard, I think having a better understanding of how outbreaks work can really help kind of focus our concern on things that we should be worrying about and maybe not dwell too much on the things that ultimately aren't going to be a major problem.
Adam Kucharski is a researcher at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He builds mathematical models that can illustrate and track the spread of infectious diseases. This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about emergencies, how we deal with them, and what to do when they happen. Japan has suffered many major disasters: earthquakes, tsunamis, typhoons, volcano eruptions, and 2 atomic bombs. So this country takes being prepared for disasters very seriously. Training for worst-case scenarios is part of the culture. There are even disaster theme parks where visitors can learn how to best get through a catastrophe. Susan Phillips visited one in Tokyo.
Okay, so I have to put this tablet on?
I've come to the Tokyo Public Bayshore Disaster Prevention Park to learn how to survive in a world without electricity, running water, heat, or air conditioning for 72 hours. I'm looking at the screen in my hands for my next clues.
You choose a language.
And I choose English.
After choosing a language, I get to choose my disaster. In this case, an earthquake.
Okay. True story?
True story.
Okay, it's 6 p.m. in December. You're on the cinema floor on the 10th floor of the station department store building. I'm on the 10th floor.
A woman in an orange jacket directs me toward an elevator. I jump on with a Chilean tourist, my Japanese translator, Hiro Sasso, and his wife, Mary Sasso, a British expat.
Press one, okay?
Press one. So this is the start.
And then it begins.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God. This is the earthquake.
Yeah.
So we should... All right, I'm going to press every button. Is that what I'm supposed to do?
After the simulated earthquake shakes the elevator, an announcer tells us to stay calm.
No, I'm not supposed to be calm.
That's right.
But the elevator door is not opening right away, which is unnerving, even though I know this is just practice.
Okay. So it opened. I pressed every button. Something opened. Okay. It's dark. Find my way out. All right, I'm getting out of here. All right.
We all stumble out into a dark hallway.
Emergency exit lights. Got it.
My tablet tells me there's a blackout. I come to a giant space. It looks like a movie set for a post-apocalyptic urban streetscape. Lights are blinking, broken glass lines the sidewalks, overturned electrical poles dangle precariously overhead, and crumbling buildings block the path. Before we can move on, the tablet computer asks me multiple choice questions like, what to do if you see a fire? Right answer, shout fire.
The first priority for the massive disaster is to save the lives. Till the outside relief rescue team is ready to provide any relief to the
questions and tour continue past crumbled buildings. Some apartment windows show fallen furniture, but the apartments where the residents had prepared for this moment have secured all their heavy furniture to the wall. I answered most of the survival questions correctly, but I made some mistakes and end up with a broken leg on the scoreboard. Next, I walk past shelters made out of cardboard boxes. Instructions show me how to make stoves out of tin cans. And signs urge me to stockpile food now.
So anyway, if quake happens right now, they will take you to the right place to evacuate. Don't worry.
The disaster park also has board games to teach children how to survive and how to use loose paper to make origami plates and cups. Like every theme park, there's a gift store. And this one includes everything you would need in a disaster.
Oh, wow.
There's Hello Kitty solar-powered lanterns, freeze-dried food, water that can be stored for 5 years, even safety-themed rice crackers in the shape of a man with a helmet, and of course your very own crash helmet kit you can assemble from cardboard and plastic.
You can fold it like this one, this way.
My translator Hiro and his wife Mary show me around the store.
Wait, emergency toilet? Yes. What is that?
Well,
what
is it? No, it's more just that it's charcoal that you can put down the toilet.
So why would you do that?
Yeah.
Because you can't flush the toilet.
Ah.
If the water is stopped. Yes.
So it's a normal, you use your normal toilet.
Yes, but use the
charcoal.
Charcoal too.
And then you also in the kit have this blanket.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
These
blankets.
Tin foil
good.
Blanket.
Yeah. Tin for toilet tin. Tin of toilet.
Oh, it's a tin of toilet.
Yes, it says. It is a
You wear that while you're on the toilet?
No.
Just keep it in your storage, you know.
Okay.
Or put it in the rucksack, which in case you take it at a time of emergency.
I'm still not sure what the blanket has to do with the toilet.
That's amazing.
How to use it.
So it's got emergency toilet.
Toilet. And this blanket.
And the blanket. And what is this?
This is a plastic bag, you know, just put underneath the toilet, okay? Then after you've done the work job, then you can put to this the powder, so make it less smelling. So then you tie it up.
So you're basically going in a plastic bag.
Yes, right.
It's just you're doing it in a toilet.
Yeah, toilet, but using plastic bag.
The Japanese seem prepared for everything. On the tour, I met Patricio Winkler. He's a civil engineer and professor from Chile who specializes in earthquakes and tsunamis.
And there are big similarities between Chile and Japan in terms of earthquakes and tsunamis.
Now, do they have anything like this in Chile where people can come and learn?
No, this kind of educational facilities? No, it's a pity. Well, they're really small visiting centers or something, but not something like this.
Patricio says disaster preparation is part of Japanese culture.
People is well prepared. You can see it like in many details. Details in the subway, for example, there's always some kind of safety box. It's kind of embedded in the everyday life. That's something that we don't have, at least. I know that in the U.S. it's not like that, neither.
No, it's definitely not like that in the U.S.
Yeah. This is strange. Let's take a selfie.
Being super prepared doesn't seem strange to my translator Hiro and his wife Mary. They know the long history of disasters that have struck Japan.
And I think also the Japanese are aware that worse than the earthquake would be a breakdown of civilization, really. And so what's important is to hold up civilized values, because I think that's what would scare me more.
The Sassos know Tokyo is overdue for a large earthquake. Some of their European friends are urging them to leave Tokyo or Japan altogether.
We have been here for many years, and things could happen as it happens.
Happen, yes.
We don't worry about it too much. So we'll deal with it.
Yes.
Well, you're prepared. And even more so, since the massive 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and subsequent nuclear meltdown at the Fukushima Daiichi plant, everyone in Japan knows where they were on March 11, 2011. The earthquake and tsunami killed close to 16,000 people and devastated the country's northeastern region. So in such a vulnerable country, it makes sense to be prepared.
That was Susan Phillips. Her story was reported with support from the International Center for Journalists. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about emergencies and disasters, how communities prepare and respond.
I was working in Oklahoma City in 1995 at the medical center there.
That's psychologist Robin Gurwitch, and back then she was working with kids with behavior problems. But then on the morning of April 19th, her life changed.
Car bomb exploded outside of a large federal building in downtown Oklahoma City, shattering that building, killing children, killing federal employees, military men, and civilians.
A rental truck packed with explosives detonated in front of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building.
And the bombing took place about a mile from my office. We actually felt the building shake.
Robin rushed over to the site of the bombing as a volunteer with the American Red Cross. 168 people were killed, including 19 children. Robin met with the families whose children died that day. She helped to identify their bodies.
I spent the next many, many, many days and months doing direct service, conducting research, developing guidance, and finding out everything I could know about the impact of these events on children and families.
The explosion changed her career, and today she continues to work with children who've experienced traumatic events.
What are some of the immediate things that you see with children after a disaster, after an emergency?
One of the biggest reactions that children have after these events is worries about their own safety, about the safety and security of the people that they care about and they love, and concerns about, am I going to be okay? Is this going to happen again? We know that worry is there. Some of the things that we see in children too is difficulties with sleep, staying asleep, falling asleep, nightmares.
Kids also may have trouble concentrating at school. Their grades could take a dip. With teenagers and preteens, Robin says there's often an increase in high-risk behavior,
such as driving fast, substance use, alcohol use, promiscuity, school absenteeism. So we really do need to be cognizant in the first few weeks to a month after a disaster. Some of these reactions are going to be quite prevalent, and then they will, for most people, begin to dissipate.
What helps kids during that first, more immediate phase? What kind of messages help them? How can the community rally around them?
The biggest thing is to make sure that they're connected with others, with their support systems, with their caregivers, parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles. That's one of the things that's so nice about schools coming back online quickly after disasters, is there's school personnel that they may feel safe and secure with. They see their friends. They can get back into activities that gave them that support. So being there, being supportive is huge.
And adults have to find ways to talk to kids about what happened.
No matter what their age is, we can put it in language they can understand, but if I don't talk directly to my child about it, I may inadvertently give the message that this is so horrible that we can't even talk about it. There's been this event. This is what happened. Tell me what you know. So we can hear from children themselves. Where do they start? We can hear what they understand. And the big message to give is, I am doing everything I know how to do to keep you safe.
Robin Gurwitch is a psychologist and professor at Duke University School of Medicine. We're talking about disasters and emergencies, how we prepare for them, what to do when they happen. Ranchers in the bush country of southern Australia all have fire stories to tell. The land can get very dry and very hot. Fires rip through the forests of eucalyptus and gum trees, scorching homes and livestock. And knowing just what to do when a fire is raging can save lives and homes. Ashley Ahern brings us this story.
Charlie Lovick is the fifth generation of Lovicks to raise cows here. His fire story takes place back in 2006. It was a bad year for fires, and the bush was burning 10 miles away from Charlie's ranch.
We had one to our north, and we had one to our south. And the authority was saying, well, it's in the bush, there's no worries. We're saying, no, if it gets in below us on the river system, it'll take us, because it'll change and it'll come through. So fire's a mischievous thing. It works out how to do stuff, I reckon.
Charlie has a grey beard and bright blue eyes with a roguish twinkle. He's lived here in the Hauqua Hills all his life, and he knows this land and the unique weather patterns here better than just about anyone.
So, lo and behold, yes, the fire did go south, southwest, and we knew it was coming. You could hear it, and you could see the glow every night. We'd sit around our places, and you could see the glow.
Local authorities told Charlie and his family to evacuate. They said if they stayed, no one would come to save them. But he and some of his close friends and neighbors decided to defend their properties. Charlie's ranch sits in a little valley surrounded by forested hills.
Well, the fire hit this high point all the way around here, and on all the way around here there was a complete red front coming our way, and we're here by ourselves.
The local authorities left a couple of bulldozers, and Charlie and his neighbors cleared strips of bare land, called fire breaks, around their properties. But they had no idea if that would make a difference. They watched the fire anxiously until nightfall, knowing it could start to move down the hillside and destroy their homes. And then Charlie saw his chance.
It was about 1 o'clock in the morning, if I remember. We call the country, got a little bit damp and a little bit doughy, so it wasn't burning so strong. And that was a great opportunity for us to go out and set the fire.
What he means is he saw an opportunity to use fire to fight fire. Charlie and his friends and neighbors walked through the forest below the encroaching fire, using torches to light a separate fire. The hope was that their fire would burn up the valley walls and rob the big fire of its fuel. It's called backburning.
But it's got to be done right. If the weather patterns are wrong way, you're going to light a fire and it's going to burn you.
Now, to be clear, Charlie broke the law when he started lighting the forest on fire. But he knew there wasn't time to ask permission.
We had a small window of opportunity, and being bushmen, you grab that straight away. You know. And we waited for the fire to come down off those ranges up there. We got about a third of the way down, and we thought, now, if we don't light this, the fire will beat us, so we need to light it at a particular time so it can burn back and snuff that fire out about halfway down the range. And it worked perfectly.
Did you cheer when you saw that your plan had worked?
Oh, mate, yeah. Well, we knew it was going to work.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But that must have been a really cool moment if you could see the fire on the ridgeline and you could see your back burn its job.
And they met. And I think it was the younger people that hadn't seen something like that happen before, they were just amazed. How bloody simple it was, if you do it the right way at the right time. So it only took an hour, and at 2 o'clock we were sitting down on the road where we lit it, and we had a couple of cold beers, as you would.
Ashley Ahern reported that story from Victoria, Australia. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Julian Harris is our intern. We had some production help from Joanna Broder. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. Tanya English, our editorial director. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.